Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Good morning, everyone. It is the 20th of September, believe it or not, and as the sun is rising this morning, we do celebrate the fact that the Son of God, Jesus Christ, is risen, and that is good news indeed. Because that tomb is empty every morning when we get up like this, it means that we once again are waking up and serving the living King of a living kingdom that knows no end. And this is Faith Radio Mornings, where we start our day together, having honest conversations about the news and top of the mind, relevant topics through the lens of genuine faith and real hope. And I am your host of the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio by my friend Logan Roush, who's running the sound and keeping everything flowing smoothly throughout the morning, break in and break out, and Paul Perot in the newsroom that just does a great job piling up my desk filled with interesting and important news articles. And of course, I see that we have my friend Jim Bilby in studio right across from me right now. Dr. Jim Bilby is a professor of Christian theology for our Thursday morning Ask Anything segment, where we love to hear from you as listeners. You've been texting in regularly, calling in regularly during the segment. This really is a time for you, if you'd like to write in about any question about the Bible, about theology, about faith. We are scared, I suppose, but not. We will address everything that you write or call in around. So good morning, Jim. It's great to have you in the studio.
Good to be here, Peter. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well, though. There was a headline that came out that I think is worth talking about. The headline itself is a little odd and perhaps somewhat humorous, but it does speak to a deeper issue that's going on. So I got to get your take before we head into our segment on this headline.
Fun.
It is a seafood restaurant in Maine that, get this, it is giving marijuana to the lobsters to put them at ease before cooking them. Customers at Charlotte's legendary Lobster Point in Seawall, Maine, can request to have their lobster sedated with marijuana when they order it. The sea creature is placed in a box with some water. Marijuana smoke is blown inside, and it helps them calm down. The owner of the restaurant goes on to say that she came up with this idea because she wanted to kill the lobsters in a more humane way. Jim, I just, you hear this headline. What are we talking about?
Well,
here?
I'm trying to understand, what's the controversial issue there? Is it eating lobster? Is that the problem?
I don't know. I mean, right. Because marijuana is not controversial at all right now, right?
No,
I noticed up in Canada yesterday, there is a stock that focuses on the development of marijuana, and the stock shot through the roof. It went from $150 a share to $300 a share, partly because they are indicating that they're probably going to be able to go mainstream with this and put marijuana in our soft drinks moving forward. I mean, wow, we're talking about killing lobsters in a more humane way, and now we're talking about soft drinks. What's happening these days?
It's out there, right? So I think the stock was like Tilray or something
exactly.
like that that went through the roof. And Coke said the other day that they were interested in adding the non-psychoactive component from marijuana, CBD, to their to having a line that would include that. So this is becoming more mainstream. This is, I imagine there are people who are of an older generation that are looking back and thinking of, you know, hippies smoking, you know, weed at Woodstock.
Right.
But the younger generation is seeing this more medicinally because we've for quite a while have had states that have legalized marijuana for medicinal use. And there's, you know, glaucoma, and there's a variety of other, you know, cancer treatments. And there's a variety of things that it's been used for. So I think part of the difficulty here is where a certain generation might look at this like, are you kidding? Lobsters and marijuana?
Right.
The younger generation is going, yeah, you know, I think that seems like maybe a good idea if you want to be humane or something like that.
Yeah.
So our society is we've always had these sort of generational divides. And I think this is another issue on which maybe we perhaps see a generational divide.
Yeah, I think that's well spotted, Jim. And this is one of those kind of conversations we need to have here on Ask Anything. We could even explore at some point in the future, maybe not this morning, but even the differences between recreational use, medicinal use, and just even the generation divide. How do we think about these things and the decisions we make in our present, how they impact our future?
Yeah. And that is for Christians, there's the whole question of what's legal. But then a better question for us to ask is, what is praiseworthy?
Yeah.
What is the sort of activity that we want to engage in that is praiseworthy, that shows the gospel in the most positive light. And these are genuine and tough questions. But you're right, there's no more important question than these.
Well, that is Jim Bilby, Dr. Jim Bilby, who's a professor of Christian theology. And we would welcome any question you have as listeners at 877-933-2484. I know after the break we're going to get into some of the different dimensions of baptism and maybe why there's infant baptism or believer baptism, early church baptism. How do we address that complicated issue next on Faith Radio Mornings? Of course, that piano music represents the beginning of our Ask Anything segment with Professor Jim Bilby, a professor of Christian theology. Jim, how long have you been teaching theology?
You know, if you go like actually getting paid for it, it's been 20 years.
So were you out in the neighborhood as like a 5 and 6 year old, just like, you know, dealing with dimensions of predestination with your friends while they're trying to do sandlot baseball?
I do remember asking my Sunday school teacher about the Trinity and getting having her sort of annoyed at my persistent questions. So I don't suppose that's teaching quite the same, but I've always been interested in theology, even when I maybe wasn't really confused about what I thought about Christianity. These questions are always really interesting to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's so fun to have you on the program. I know the listeners have been calling and texting in different questions throughout these last Thursday episodes. And so please do join us at 877-933-2484. I believe we've covered things like the immortality of angels, whether we've actually met angels, any number of conversations. And I know the one we want to get into this morning, Jim, is a little bit about baptism, which I know for our students often coming into our classes and from a variety of denominational backgrounds and perspectives are probably a bit confused about why some denominations advocate for infant baptism, some advocate for believer baptism. It may be different altogether than how baptism was maybe practiced in the early church. So I'd be curious, maybe as a starting point there, I've always wondered, how was it that if, quote unquote, a head of a household was baptized in the early church, that it was considered that the entire household was then baptized? Yeah. Am I reading these stories correctly, like in the book of Acts?
Sure. Biblical material in the early bit of the early church, the book of Acts, the New Testament books, it's a really difficult question because you have these Jewish people that have a very clear set of understandings about what it means to enter covenant and signs of covenant that are associated with that and circumcision and things like that, that were very clear as when you're entering into covenant, this is what you do. But then you're in breaking into Greek culture, and now they don't have some of those same backgrounds. My point is that there's lots of opportunity for misunderstanding and differences of opinion here. The question about like households being baptized, when absolutely the Book of Acts says entire households are baptized, and people infer from that, well, clearly that means infants were baptized. Well, that's far from obvious, right? Because when you're talking about households and a lot of other senses, the only people that really, sadly, in that culture mattered were the males, you know, and so perhaps male servants or sons or something like that. So there's debate about what it means to say that entire households were baptized. Typically, baptism was absolutely something that was done for purification, and it was often done in the Old Testament for a dedication of your life to Christ or a recognition of that fact. So the New Testament picks that up and says once you have committed your life to Christ, that there's this dedication that happens. But in a culture where there's lots of kids that are dying at a very young age, very, very quickly, the question started becoming, well, wait a minute, what about my kids that have a 20% chance of dying before the age of one?
Right.
And those questions became very pressing for the early church.
Well, and I think in the early church, my understanding is that if you wanted to say yes to becoming part of the way, or how they described becoming part of the Christian faith, that part of that yes is that you would enter into around a 2-year process oftentimes of making sure your faith was sound and secure in the midst of this persecution. You wanted to say yes to something that might ultimately lead up to your death. So you were a catechumen, they described them to be, for about 2 years learning about the faith before then on Easter Vigil, you entered into the waters of baptism.
Absolutely right. And so then that was the understanding of the faith. Now, so that's absolutely correct, right? So it's hard to deny that. The question becomes, though, How do we understand that if circumcision is the standard, the Old Testament standard, and that's something that happens with infants? Yeah. So I'm not here actually. At full disclosure, I teach at Bethel University and we're a Baptist background, and so we actually have a stance on this, and so I want to be careful.
Right.
Jay Barnes, I'm not saying anything I shouldn't say here, right? So there's a real argument to be made coming out of that Old Testament context that if the sign of the covenant was circumcision, and that's something that happens at a, you know, for babies,
right?
How do we think about that, and how do we pull that forward? And so, again, there are a lot of opportunities for misunderstanding. And I think, and I just want to throw this out, what if we thought of, yes, this action as a believer that we make to affirm our faith is absolutely crucial, but what if we thought of there being something as a child that happens that was equally important because that God surrounds this family, and this family desires to draw this child into faith?
Well, I think that is a wonderful tease for a break right now. We'll take a break a little early and get into some ideas of infant baptism when it first showed up in the church, and at least in its fullness right now, and what maybe some arguments would be for that. More to come with Professor Jim Bilby of Christian Theology here on the Ask Anything segment on Faith Radio Mornings. It's just about 19 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and we have a caller on the line, Dana from Plymouth, Minnesota, that we'll get to in just a second with a great question about preaching the gospel to people of the Jewish faith. But, Jim, we've been talking about baptism this morning, and maybe we can put a little bow on this segment knowing that we need much more conversation to really get into this. But there obviously is often a divide between there should be infant baptism, believer baptism. Some of these things are anchored in history that would be really important to get into. But you have an interesting take that could advocate a little bit for both.
Yeah, so... part of it comes down to the question of when we use the term baptism, to what rite are we referring? And sometimes theological debates just become about who gets to use the word. And I got to tell you, I get a little disinterested when it's just about that.
Yeah.
Right. So I would rather zoom back out and say, you know what? Let's call it baptism schmaptism. You know, what things are we as Christians called to do?
Yeah.
And I think there is a real powerful sense that when a person enters into faith, that they demonstrate that faith in this time-honored way through baptism, and actually love the full immersion, you know, dying, being made alive again. So I think that's absolutely great. I love that idea. Now, the problem is people who baptize infants that say there should be something important that happens on the front end for this child, they go, well, wait a minute. You're then rebaptizing if you're baptizing as a believer, right? So how about this? What if we said there's something really important that should happen in the life of the child, that the family and the church should come around this child, and there can be this ordinance, this rite, this dedication, again, whatever you want to call it, that draws this child into faith. So sometimes the language of prevenient grace is used, grace that goes before the child's decision to accept. That's great. Let's do that. Does that mean we're rebaptizing? No, because it's a fundamentally different thing.
Yeah.
Drawing a child into faith and that child demonstrating and choosing to demonstrate their faith through the act of being baptized, or again, whatever you want to, affirming their faith or whatever you want to call it. Those are radically different things. So I would say baptizing as a believer is not rebaptizing in the same way that lunch is not re-breakfasting.
Okay. I think that's a great analogy, Jim, on that. It's fascinating when you look, and I think you and I, maybe we need to go out to breakfast after the show. We invite all the listeners to come join us on this conversation, all right? We'll fill up the restaurant. But I when you look at why Jesus was baptized, we understand that baptism didn't start in the New Testament. There's a historical precedent in the Old, and what was that? There's so much to get into that can help shape this conversation.
Yep.
Too much.
There always
is. There always is for Ask Anything. But I'd love at this point to bring Dana on the line from Plymouth, Minnesota, who has a question about just how do we handle walking out the gospel with people of the Jewish faith. So, Dana, are you on the line? Good morning.
Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
Well, I'm doing great. Thanks for calling in with your question. So, talk to us. What do you have for us this morning on Ask Anything?
We had a dear friend that we lost to cancer, and she was Jewish. And there were seven of us girls, five of us strong believers, who witnessed to her all the time. And as I was reading, and I'm in the car now, so I can't tell you what the verse was, it talked about God would harden the hearts of the Jews. And I just kept thinking, has God hardened her heart? Mm. God loves her. He doesn't want any to fall away. Why? I mean, she saw the witness of, you know, five strong, faithful women who loved her, loved Jesus, and we lost her, you know, and I, you know, it was between her and God. I don't know if she's in heaven or not, but that pearls to the swine thing, you know, what does that really mean? God hardened their hearts.
Mm. Oh, Dana, that is a fabulous question. Thanks for calling in with that this morning. Jim, I can't rescue you with a break on this one. We still got 5 minutes left in this segment.
Yeah,
this is a tricky one, is it not? I mean, we read some things in the text about how God hardened Pharaoh's heart perhaps at times. Mm. And how do we understand this hardening of the heart, and specifically Dana's question, which is a very poignant story?
Yeah, so the question of God hardening our hearts is one of those really difficult ones, because it does seem to conflict with the idea, you know, if God desires all people to be saved, God desires that none should perish, you know, there's so many passages that you know, talk about God's love for all people and his desire to be in relationship with all people, and that doesn't seem to fit with these references to hardening of heart.
Right.
Right? So let's keep in mind that what Scripture says is that all people who are in sin have hardened their heart against God, right? Now, the question is, how do we think about God hardening people's heart? And let's look at the account in Exodus about God hardening Pharaoh's heart. If you look at that entire account, Pharaoh hardened his heart, and then Pharaoh hardened his heart again, and then Pharaoh hardened his heart again. There's like all these different times that Pharaoh hardened his heart, and then God hardened Pharaoh's heart for the purpose of making his glory even more known in that story. So there are times that God steps in and goes, really? You already set against me. So he'd already hardened his heart like 3 or 4 times. You're already set against me. So I am going to harden your heart right here in this instance for the purpose of making my name known in this powerful way, right? And so we know the rest of the story and how the people of Israel came out of the land and all of that. So there are times, and then with respect to the Jewish people, there are times that Scripture talks about God hardening the heart of the Israelites for the purpose of making his name known to the Gentiles, right? And so Romans has some really interesting stuff. Romans 11 in particular, some really interesting stuff about how there was in God's purpose, and I think you can see this all the way back in Genesis 12, that God, you know, is going to through Abraham. He says, Abe, and for those of you who know him well, you can call him Abe. Abe, I'm going to make of you a great nation through which I will bless all nations.
Yeah.
So God always had this plan, this design that was broader than the nation of Israel. And so the hardening of the heart of Israel was a part of God's plan to bring about the salvation of all people. But again, the hardening of the heart, I don't think we see as a, that's it, you're done, no more plan, no more hope. God's grace is still offered to them. It's a functional hardening of the heart for a particular purpose to bring the gospel to others.
Yeah, and I think, and to Dana's question then, we just have a couple minutes left, where maybe something like this could happen to somebody and where God hardens their heart, but there's nothing really within the Bible that indicates that as soon as we die, our location is fixed forever and ever and ever. I mean, there's a lot of conversation about what happens right after we die and judgments to come. This isn't just a simple thing. Some people, even like C.S. Lewis, could be seen as advocating for a choice post this life, even that there's more future to come. I mean, it's unclear at best in these conversations.
Yeah. I think the best thing we can say here is that God is a loving God that pursues us in every way that he possibly can, and that he knows how to do that, and he knows what his plans are, and sometimes we don't see exactly what that plan is, but that God is a loving God is going to pursue us in ways that we maybe sometimes can't even imagine, and maybe sometimes might be outside of our nice, neat theological boxes.
Yeah, I think that's well said. Jim and Dana, thank you so much for the question. So many dimensions of that. And before we go here, Jim, I'd be curious, is there anything, going back to this baptism conversation, any one thing you said, you know, if I had a year ahead, I would really like to explore this dimension of baptism or something about that, where you could really focus the time on some part of it?
Yeah, I mean, so there's so much interesting work right now being done on the history of the early church, and what it actually meant to say that households were being baptized, and when it started becoming a practice to baptize infants, and how that was actually being understood. Was that a stopgap? And, oh, my goodness, these children are dying, and we need to find a way to make it more likely for them to be saved? What was going on there?
Yeah.
And how does that interface with the persecution that's going on in the early church? How does that interface with the development of theological, certain questions are coming up and people are developing answers to that? And so there's so much that's going on from a historical point of view that's really interesting that I would personally love to get into more.
No, there's just so much there. I mean, we've covered sort of the recreational medicinal use of marijuana this morning, hardness of heart, and baptism. Real simple morning, simple topics on this.
Oh, yeah,
so,
easy.
Yeah, I'll look forward to seeing you for breakfast for about the next 4 years after this to keep talking about these topics. Thanks for joining us in studio again, Jim. It's such an important segment.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break for a break point and bottom of the hour news. And in the second half of this hour, I'll be joined by Dr. Richard Land. And he was once named one of the top 25 most influential evangelicals in 2005 in our country. I'm going to ask him about some of the differences of life in our culture then versus today. So much more to come on Faith Radio Mornings. Love that Ask Anything segment. We could go on, it feels like, for hours and hours on these different questions. Just Jim's accessibility and willingness to come in and address these difficult issues. I know as my students come into the class from a variety of denominational and Christian backgrounds that oftentimes they have these questions that paralyze them moving forward. So, boy, if I had an opportunity to hang with Jim over breakfast and talk about these things and invite all of you around our listening audience, we would certainly break down the doors of the restaurant, but it would be fun. Well, I know we have Dr. Richard Land coming up next in the program, and he's been part of the evangelical sort of circles and culture for many years, a giant in these circles, and looking forward to get his take on any number of issues over the day in our culture and how the church can come around them. So much more to come on Faith Radio Mornings. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, we were joined by Bill English of BibleInBusiness.com, and Bill was giving some tips about what investors want to see in a business pitch.
The real value is in the marriage of the idea with the money. The idea by itself has no value. I don't care how great your idea is. If you can't get it to market and monetize it, it's a worthless idea. It's really about the cash flow and the profitability to the investor. It's not going to be about how great the idea is. And it's also going to be about who you are as a person, because the investor is probably investing in you more than the idea. And so who you are as a person, how you come across, how well put together your financials are, how well put together your business plan is, how well put together you are as a leader and a person will directly influence their willingness to invest in you.
That was Bill English. If you want to catch that entire segment in which he talks about people coming forward and pitching their ideas, it was an amazing sort of pseudo Shark Tank experience that investors and entrepreneurs can experience together. He, of course, is the longest running guest on Faith Radio Mornings and does a great job on Wednesdays. You can go to myfaithradio.com and search for Bill English or Investors Entrepreneurs and catch that entire segment. Well, I see we have Dr. Richard Land on the line already. He was the president of Southern Evangelical Seminary, among many of the roles and posts that he's held, for a long time being a voice for evangelicalism and family in our culture. Looking forward to conversations next, specifically about how the challenges facing families have really changed over these last 15 years. So more to come on Faith Radio Mornings.
When your teen hits a rough patch, you need to understand the implications on the entire household. For instance, dealing with a struggling teen can be hard on your marriage. Really hard. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. A struggling teen can drive a nasty wedge between a husband and wife. So mom, dad, stand up to the pressure that threatens your relationship. Present a united front to your teen and insist that your child treat both of you with respect. Become co-warriors in the cause. Mom, support your husband. Dad, don't whip out on your wife. Two warriors united in battle will keep a child from self-destructing. Let your teen know that you're working together for a common cause, a healthy and happy home.
Want to hear Mark in person? For a list of upcoming events, go to parentingtodaysteens.org.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and I'm thrilled to be joined in the line by Dr. Richard Land, who's the president of Southern Evangelical Baptist Seminary and has just held so many different roles over the last 20, 30 years in evangelicalism in our country, including being part of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission and being serving five times with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom that he was appointed to by former President Bush and other politicians along the way. Good morning, and thanks for joining us, Dr. Land.
Well, good morning, and I am a Baptist, but it is not, it's not Southern Evangelical Baptist Seminary, it's Southern Evangelical Seminary.
I got you. Yeah, we don't want to mix up those denominational terms, Dr. Land. You know, I'm a bit of a denominational mutt. I've been through all the different denominations, it feels like, so I get confused myself from time to time.
That's okay. We about half our students are Baptist, and the other half are, you know, Bible church and evangelical free church, et cetera.
Well, I would love to hear your take, just even as you've been involved in seminary life, that I know around the country there's been decreasing enrollment in seminary, that vocational ministry seems to be on the decline. Is that because of some of the ongoing secularization of our culture and there just isn't quite as an esteemed role? Is it because of just the job culture that we're in where it's tough to make a living? What are you seeing and the challenges moving forward in vocational ministry?
Well, I think there are many reasons for it. I think the one is, you can't abort 30% of your future students over two generations and not have a declining pool from which to take students.
Mm.
We have fewer young people and middle-aged people that are in the age categories that normally go to seminary. Secondly, I think that we do have more and more people who are serving the church, either part-time or full-time, who have been mentored in the church, and there's less emphasis by the churches on having people who have formal vocational training. And I'm of a mixed feeling about that. I've given, most of my life to educational endeavor and to ministry, and I believe that we ought to do our very best to be equipped to the fullest extent possible. But at the same time, Billy Graham never went to seminary, and I'm awfully glad that he was ordained and had the wonderful ministry he had. And we don't want to make man's requirements substitute for God's requirements. If someone's been called to serve and called to preach, then we one of the reasons we're so committed to online education is that we want to try to get as much education, as much information, as much equipping as we can out to the people where they are. Because for every one student who can pick up and come to Charlotte, we can reach 10 through the miracle of the internet, and they can be in class live interacting with the professor and the other students thousands of miles away from Charlotte.
Well, and that online disruption has really made, obviously, a huge impact these last 10 years and in our churches as well. I would love your take on sort of the positives and maybe some negatives, if there are any, relative to some of these multi-campus streaming megachurch situations that you're located in one campus somewhere physically, but then you're streaming out to multiple campuses around the city, sometimes around the country. And what I see, Dr. Land, is that there's some churches and local communities that can't keep up anymore because everybody's going to the streaming churches. Are there positives and negatives to this online mechanism for church?
Well, there are. There are always positives and negatives to technological development, and it's foolish not to recognize them and to try to mitigate the negatives and accentuate the positives. I think that what it does, one of the positives is that it, it's the people who are the best communicators, the people who are the most gifted, who are usually the ones being streamed. And so you have people, many more people being exposed to often extraordinary preaching and extraordinary exposition and teaching of God's Word. But, preaching, as important as it is, does not make a church a church. A church needs discipleship and it needs fellowship. And so I think one of the ways to mitigate against this is to make certain that when they're streaming it out, they're streaming it to congregational locations as well as just to homes. And because, the Bible tells us, do not forsake the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is. We are not going to be all that God wants us to be apart from fellowship with other Christians on a regular basis in a local church. I think the New Testament is crystal clear about that, that it is only together corporately with other believers that we're going to be able to plumb the depths and scale the heights and embrace the width of all that God has for us. And so if the preaching is coming from a remote location, you need to have people together. You need to hopefully have some pastoral staff that are committed to that location and that are ministering to the pastoral needs of the people in that particular location.
Yeah, it seems like the balance of the both. I know so many people that are feeling isolated and fragmented these days, so the flesh and blood of being in a church community can help mitigate that. This is Dr. Richard Land, who's the president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. But it's just among the many posts and leadership roles he's played within evangelicalism over the years. You may know his voice from Bringing Every Thought Captive, a segment that plays regularly on affiliates all over the country. Dr. Land, when we come back from break, I would love your take on some of the shift and change that you've seen in the family and specifically the challenges facing the family in our country. I know these last 15 years, maybe historically, have been more difficult to navigate than any time in history. And I would love just for you to rewind us back to what some of the challenges were and what we're facing now. So much more to come with Dr. Richard Land here on Faith Radio Mornings. It's about 11 minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and delighted to be joined on the line by Dr. Richard Land, who is the president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. We're talking about just dimensions of our faith intersecting with culture in a variety of ways. And Dr. Land, you're a native Houstonian, and I don't know if you're a baseball fan, but October baseball around the corner here. Are your Astros going to repeat this year? What does it look like?
Well, I certainly hope so. I am a huge Astros fan. I grew up about 5 miles from the Astrodome, and we're still getting a nosebleed from having won the World Championship. That's the first one ever. So I would love to see us repeat. I think they certainly have a chance to. They're, I think, leading the Oakland A's, and they're certainly going to be in the playoffs. The question is what their seeding will be.
Yeah, well, their pitching staff from top to bottom is going to be pretty tough to beat. It'd be fun to watch on that. Well, I'd love your take on just you've been working with family and you've observed culture and participated in leadership evangelically in the culture for just a number of years now. And if we could rewind ourselves somehow and remember what life was like in the early 2000s versus today for families, what would you say are some of the most pressing challenges and changes that have taken shape over these last 15 years?
Well, let's talk about the mega issue first. That's the Internet. The Internet, the growth of the Internet and social media has changed everything. It has impacted everything, and it has accentuated all the bad things. Pornography, for instance. The average age of exposure in 2001 for an American male to hardcore pornography was 16. Now it's 11.
Wow.
And that's because every child that's carrying around a cell phone, a smartphone, has in his pocket a potential horrifically graphic adult bookstore. And those pornographers are trying desperately to get to him. And there aren't that many filters, and there aren't that many impediments. And most of these boys, when their first exposure is not at home, it's on a friend's cell phone or it's in a friend's house, and we can't even imagine the damage that does. You know, we talk a lot about the Me Too movement and the sexual predators in our society. When you literally inundate a society with hardcore pornography, much of which has predatory themes and exploitive themes of women, then you're shocked when you find that the men in that culture are acting in a sexually predatory fashion. That's a no-brainer. Every issue has been put on steroids in terms of impacting the family by social media and by the Internet. And one of the most important things that parents have to do is do everything they can to limit their children's exposure to material that is damaging to children, Christian or non-Christian children. So it accelerates change. And it causes change to be far more penetrating, even of the local family home.
Well, and I think on a real practical basis, because you're right, it's just carrying around the possibility of pornography in our pockets as teenagers or even younger than that now. It's hard to even find filters that kids can't get around or other ways to access it. And yet, as parents, I know we don't want our kids to feel left out or left behind or experience even kind of any bullying in school. But would you suggest that parents maybe limit or don't even help their kids have access to smartphones, don't give them at all during their growing up years?
Oh, it depends. I think once they get to be 12 or 13, they need to have a smartphone. But I do think you do need to get filters, and you do need to make it clear that there will be monitoring. You know, you can't erase what you look at. I mean, it's there. And one of the great evils of pornography, online pornography, either on the smartphone or on the computer, is that it has the myth of anonymity. People think that they can expose themselves to this material and remain anonymous. First of all, they're not anonymous to the people whose site they're on because they can find out who they are. Secondly, there's no way to erase this material. They can go back with the proper technology, and they can find what you've been looking at. And when I was head of the ERLC, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, I would get phone calls with increasing frequency from pastors of local churches who were brokenhearted because they wanted to start a daycare ministry to minister to their community. And these insurance companies have figured out that they'd better go in and do a monitor and run through all the churches' computers to minimize the possibility of suits for child abuse, sexual abuse. And these pastors are brokenhearted at what they have found out on occasion about what their staff members were viewing at church on church computers.
Hmm. It's Dr. Richard Land. And Dr. Land, you've been involved, obviously, in politics in a number of those scenes as well. So in our remaining time, just sort of shift the conversation to that realm for a moment. How are you processing some of the rancor that's going on in Washington? And you even referenced the Me Too movement, as well as how women have been treated in our country. And, of course, coming out this week out of Supreme Court hearings, we see both sides of this and such rancor and such division. You were on the inside of this for a number of years. How are you processing what's happening now?
Well, it's a continuation. It's a continuum. It's been going on. It's worse now. The American people elected a president who was committed to fundamentally changing the power structure in Washington, D.C. If you listen to his inaugural address, I mean, I was sitting there with my mouth open in stunned silence as I watched it live. He declared war on a Republican and Democratic, a bipartisan political establishment that has shown signs of existing far more for its own benefit than for the benefit of the country they were elected to serve. And this thing over the current Supreme Court nomination, there is nothing that it appears that the liberal establishment will not do to try to subvert Judge Kavanaugh's nomination, because they understand that for 70 years they have been imposing their views on marriage, their views on abortion, their views on pornography, and how open it should be in our society on the American people.
Well, I think, Dr. Land, too, just that you're saying that so well in terms of what's going on in the rancor in Washington. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We got to take our top of the hour break here, but we appreciate your perspective and just the wisdom you bring to these situations. Love to have you on again here on Faith Radio Mornings. Well, what a fun show today, starting with Ben Johnson in that first hour, talking through the news headlines of the day, to Justin Gibney of the AND campaign, Jim Bilby, professor of Christian theology, talking about baptism, and of course ending with Dr. Richard Land, who has as much perspective and wisdom on these kind of issues facing our country as we can find around our world. And so we appreciate all of our guests, appreciate you as listening, and remember, as you do the rest of your day, the tomb is empty, the kingdom never ends.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.